Albert Einstein said, "We can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them." With this advice in mind, with the world economy still reeling from last fall's collapse, with Nova Scotia just electing Atlantic Canada's first NDP government, the Coast has convened its economic advisory panel to do some different thinking for Nova Scotia. I'm Kyle Shaw, editor and co-founder of The Coast, and I'll be moderator for these proceedings. I've also got a confession to make. This panel started as a joke. Not long after the global financial meltdown started last September, Nova Scotia's then premier, Rodney MacDonald, announced he'd formed an economic advisory panel to help steer the province through these troubled times. The names on his list are the usual suspects of Nova Scotia business, representing the major companies literally doing business as usual here. In other places, it was these sort of traditional pillars of the business community who are exactly the people who caused this global economic mess in the first place. So at the Coast, we looked at the list and we laughed. Of course we can make a better advisory panel, we said. So we put together a well-rounded list of interesting thinkers, and we published it. And that's what we do. That's all we have to do as media. And then one of the people we named, and I can't remember who it was, but someone around this table may want to claim the credit. One of you suggested you got in touch with us and suggested that, hey, when you put this thing together for real, give me a call, I'd like to participate. And I think this panel could really generate some good advice and keep me on your list. So that helped to see this alternative advisory panel as less a list of names to needle the premier with, and more of a group of people who can really help the province. And with the election a couple weeks ago giving Premier Daryl Dexter an unprecedented NDP majority and an unprecedented mandate to govern differently, we figured this is the time for our panel of people who think differently. This new government is in a position to take these concerns and perspectives seriously, so let's give it to them. With that said, I'll bring our advisors in now. Please start with Susanna. Go around and introduce yourself.
I'm Susanna Fuller. I am the Marine Coordinator at the Ecology Action Center.
My name is Angela Giles. I'm the Atlantic Regional Organizer for the Council of Canadians and also here representing the board for the Nova Scotia Citizens Healthcare Network.
I'm Tony Tracy, and I'm the Atlantic Regional Representative for the Canadian Labour Congress, which represents 3.5 million workers from coast to coast.
Dan Roscoe with Scotian Windfields. We're a community-based developer of renewable energy projects.
I'm Patricia Bishop. I'm here from the Annapolis Valley. I come from a family firm there and my own firm, Taproot Firms, and I also am working with the Kings County Federation of Agriculture, representing farmers in Kings County.
Ron Coleman, I'm founder and executive director of GPI Atlantic. GPI is a Genuine Progress Index, which is an effort to measure our progress more holistically in a way that integrates social, economic, and environmental perspectives.
I'm Jeff Moore. I'm the founder and CEO of Just Us Coffee Roasters, Canada's first fair trade coffee roaster. And in the beginning, some 14 years ago, we set out to do the coffee business differently.
Right. Okay. Thank you all, and I welcome you to the Coast Boardroom in beautiful North End Halifax. It's the last Friday in June 2009, and we want to look forward a few years to talk about where Nova Scotia needs to go and what Daryl Dexter needs to do. But first, I want to figure out where we are right now. I look around Nova Scotia, and I see it's the regional capital. Government is important here. Healthcare is huge here. The Navy is important. These are things that aren't affected by the collapse of the world's financial sector. And we don't have many factories to be affected by a manufacturing slowdown. Another way to put that is that Nova Scotia's economy is so small, it doesn't have very far to fall when the rest of the world tumbles. So, what does the global meltdown mean to us? How bad is it for Nova Scotians right now? Jeff Moore. Just us? Are people still buying coffee?
Yeah. No, people. The fortunate thing is once people try coffee that's fresher and has a better flavor, it's hard to go back to the old industrial type coffee. So we're continuing to grow in our cafes, we consider our retail part and also the wholesale part and through the retail food stores.
Angela, people still getting sick?
Yes, as far as I understand it, yeah, people are getting sick for sure. But in terms of the current situation and what's been happening sort of under the McDonald government, I mean, privatization has been continuing to occur in the healthcare system, with, for example, the signing of the Scotia Surgery contract with Capital Health, and also the telecare contract that was recently announced, $20 million for a call a nurse type program. And so, you know, this is something that is, that the public healthcare system as we know it has basically been eroding under the McDonald government.
I think, Kyle, you missed out one. You said government, healthcare, and Navy, and you missed the fishery. And I think fishery is something, certainly for the lobster fishermen, that has been greatly affected by the economic downturn because their fishery is almost 99% export-oriented. And there was a bit of a backlog of product. And while the fishermen sell to the processors, the fishermen and the processors had the backlog. Now we see the bailout coming for the fishermen, and that's directly a result of the economic downturn. And we even see Clearwater, who almost faced bankruptcy and had to be bailed out for $10 million by the Nova Scotia government because of its leveraging by foreign banks. So I think that's a big one that's definitely been affected by the economic downturn.
Yeah, I would also argue that in the world we have today, that even small jurisdictions are not shielded from a global economic crisis. So to the degree to which we're dependent on exports, we're going to be affected. I think you hit the nail on the head in your introductory remarks that the big flaw that I see presently is that everyone's talking about stimulating the economy so that we can somehow get back to where we were, to this so-called boom period. And there's very little recognition that there's a relationship between the meltdown we're experiencing now and the nature of the boom period that preceded it. That this is the this is not part of the analysis. Everyone talks about recovering as if we want to recover to where we were. Where we were was ecologically unsustainable. We were overproducing, overconsuming, producing waste and greenhouse gas emissions at a rate that the planet could not handle. But even financially, a lot of that growth during the so-called boom period was debt-fueled. It was fueled by growing levels of debt. People were encouraged, being given easy credit to spend beyond their means. So it was also financially unsustainable. So if we don't look at the causes, and we simply try to recover to where we were, we're just headed to ever steeper boom and bust cycles, raising expectations unrealistically, and then leading to cruel disappointment. So I think we have to look at that whole picture more realistically than current conventional analysis has done.
Okay, if we don't want to recover, where do we want to go, or what do we want to do?
I don't think it's that we don't want to quote unquote recover. I just think that we need to establish a more sustainable path moving forward. As Ron said, you know, that racking, whether it's through debt and on the financial side, or whether it's through our resources, whether they're in the fishery or agriculture or energy, forestry, you know, all of our policies have been geared towards economic quote unquote economic growth, but moving forward, that, you know, the resources that we're developing that growth are limited, and we're not using them in a sustainable way. Specifically on the energy side, a lot of the run-up in the sort of the boom period was because of the high price of energy, and we haven't gotten away from that. There will still be a high price of energy. You know, we are in a quote-unquote economic crisis, but we still have this historically very high oil prices. Coal prices are also quite high, and we're going to see that to continue to move forward. We are in still a very dire position here in Nova Scotia as we import the vast majority of our energy, despite having tremendous renewable energy resources from all types imaginable, whether it's the wind or if it's biomass or if it's wave or tidal. So we feel that there's a tremendous potential there to shift away. Actually, it was Rob Bennett who coined the term repatriate our energy supply, to bring it home. Right now, we send every kilowatt hour we spend 10 cents or 12 cents on a kilowatt hour, 8 or 9 cents of that leaves the province and goes somewhere else, where we could be turning that into jobs and manufacturing and renewable energy products and installations, insulating all of our homes and making them more efficient. And that right there will not only solve our energy crisis, but also help stimulate our economy.
So what's the first step for Daryl Dexter to start repatriating our energy supply?
I think the first step needs to be, and there are many steps, but I think we need to have a new definition of cost when it comes to energy. Right now we have a very narrow definition of cost, and it's a kilowatt hour today. And we have this feeling that it doesn't matter what the source is or where it's coming from or the emissions associated with it or where it's from, that a kilowatt hour, the cheapest kilowatt hour is the best. We have this mantra that renewable energy and all this stuff costs more, but we need to come to the reality that our status quo when it comes to energy is going to be by far the most expensive. That oil is going to continue to skyrocket in the long term, so will all, like, natural gas and coal. That's the worst case scenario, is to do nothing. And we need, I guess, Daryl Dexter to take the leadership to recognize that that there is value in fixed costs from renewable energy and in local supply that generates local economic activity. And I think recognizing the full cost, the full benefits associated, where it's from, is it going to be the same price tomorrow as it was today? Is it going to be the same price 10 years from now that it is today? Recognizing that with our energy supply and being able to convince the public of that as well, which is the huge battle, is going to be an important step for Daryl and his team to tackle the energy issue.
And I would say that Dan's point was definitively proven by the Stern report in the United Kingdom. So Lord Nicholas Stern, former chief economist of the World Bank, said, yes, it's going to be expensive to shift from our conventional so-called cheap oil to a new system. And he estimated that it would cost 1% of global GDP to make that shift. He said doing nothing will cost us between 5 and 20%. Of global GDP, because the true costs of climate change are not figured into the apparently cheap cost of oil.
No, we don't have a price on carbon yet that has been driving this increase, and our carbon liability here in Nova Scotia is tremendous. We have the highest emissions per capita for our electricity supply in North America, if not the world. It's quite outstanding. So luckily, we have a great resource to be able to draw on. If we were in a place like somewhere else that didn't have the resources, say Southern Ontario, that doesn't have the renewable resources that we have, I think we'd be in a much worse off position.
I think it's interesting that we do have these renewable resources, but really where we've gone in the past is to make it as easy as possible for offshore oil and gas development to go ahead, and that's a direct export from the province. But it's also in conflict with fisheries resource, which theoretically is a sustainable resource, and more extraction of oil and gas is an unsustainable resource. And where we were heading was to open up even George's Bank, which is the only reason we have any bit of George's Bank in Canada, is because it was a historical fishing ground. Mm-hmm. And we were moving towards even opening that up for oil and gas exploration to sell directly to the U.S. When the eastern seaboard of the U.S. is off limits to oil and gas exploration. So I always talk about us a little bit as a banana republic in that sense, that we want to give away as much as we can for as low cost as we can, hoping that we get some government resources from it. And I see Nova Scotia under the Conservative government trying to follow where Danny Williams has taken Newfoundland, which once he's as good, you see economic growth, people coming home, but the cost of the environment is so high, not being calculated in. And in Nova Scotia and in Newfoundland, we have the opportunity to really switch. So when I think of economic stimulus I think of reinvent. Like, we have this time to reinvent, and crisis times of crisis equal times of opportunity, and I'm not. Maybe we have that in Nova Scotia. Like I always see us on the edge of great potential, but never actually reaching it. And that's why it's the exciting time, also a bit of a scary time. And if we can really figure out how to recount things as well, and what we mean in terms of economy, and get the public to support that, then we have a real chance of doing it.
Let's look forward. How much time do we have?
10 years.
Ten max.
Yeah. 10 years to get started, or 10 years to be at a new place?
Yeah. 10 years to make a decisive shift. I mean, I've done nothing but look at statistics for the last 13 years, and I think that we have a very narrow and increasingly small window of opportunity, that if we have business as usual for the next 10 years, then it'll be too late to reverse certain things which will lead to an inevitable decline in global prosperity. So I think we have a very small window of opportunity.
Yeah, fortunately, we're not isolated. We're part of a worldwide movement that's changing quite dramatically as the days go by. You talk about banana republics, and the people of Honduras, which is your classic banana republic, are in the streets today challenging business as usual under American domination. They're saying, no, we're not going to take it anymore. We're going to the streets. And this is a very passive country that's accepted foreign domination for a long time. Mm-hmm. So it's quite exciting.
It is exciting, and it's exciting to see those type of things happening, not just in Honduras, but Bolivia, Venezuela. The people's movements in the global south are actually where many of us are taking inspiration at this point. But just to bring us back to some of your opening comments, because you mentioned, Kyle, in your opening comments, you gave a synopsis of the economy in Halifax proper, and I think it was a fairly good synopsis. It's Halifax has the advantage in the sense that it's propped up considerably by a high level of public services. We have, as you said, the military, universities, a fair number of public services. At the same time, we've seen in the past 3 months an incredible increase, a disproportionate increase in employment insurance applications in the Halifax area. In Nova Scotia, there are a number of geographic districts bounded in employment insurance boundaries, and Halifax has actually seen a higher percentage increase than other areas. And that's stunning in many ways, because we have in Nova Scotia, outside of Halifax, where we don't have those high level of public services in other communities, what we see as communities in crisis. And many of those communities are going through a massive, massive problem. We see in the Annapolis Valley, over recent months, we've seen the closure of Eastern Protein Foods, a large food production company. We've seen the layoffs at ACA Co-op, which is, again, a chicken production plant. In Liverpool, in the South Shore, we see the Abitibi Bowwater Mill, which has gone through three successive five-week shutdowns in the past 4 month period. Folks have worked for a few weeks, been laid off for 5 weeks, come back to work for a few weeks, laid off for 5 weeks, and that trend seems to be continuing in that community in crisis in Liverpool and the South Shore. We've seen, of course, the closures at Trenton Works in Pictou County. We've seen a Magna plant, auto parts manufacturer close in Cape Breton, and we're seeing communities across the province that are going through dramatic crisis. There's a number of things which the provincial government can do in the context of this. And I think one of the things we need to look at is the example from the 1930s. In one of the deepest recessionary periods possible and that we've seen until today, we had some of the greatest advances in trade union rights and workers' rights in that period. So in the US under Roosevelt, we saw the Wagner Act in the mid-1930s that actually regularized trade unions and actually brought trade unions into being in terms of legal entities. Because up until that point, you had to strike for recognition. You had to actually take people out of the workplace just to get a basic recognition that you had a union. And from 1936 with the Wagner Act in the US, onwards, they brought in a system under the National Labor Relations Board in which people could actually vote internally within the workplace and actually form a union. They had processes around it. In Canada, we saw the same thing within a couple of years, just pre-war. And during the Depression period, it was called Privy Council Order 1003. And again, it regularized labor standards. And actually, that's the period in which we made the most gains in workers' rights ever in history in North America was during the Depression. And I see an opportunity, and actually an opportunity without cost to the provincial government, a zero cost opportunity, to actually bring money into local economies, into local communities, by ensuring that workers have the right to form unions in the workplaces. Some of the things which we in the labor movement are calling for are card check recognition, the ability for workers to be able to sign union cards, and when the majority of workers in the workplace have signed union cards, then you have a union that's recognized. You don't have to go through a long fight with the boss. The boss has, of course, caused this crisis. The crisis wasn't caused by workers, and yet workers are faced with the results of the crisis. Today, ACA Co-op, a chicken plant in the valley, has a purchaser, which has gone to the union, the Canadian Auto Workers, and demanded an $8 an hour pay decrease for them to buy this plant and put some millions of dollars into renovations into the plant. $8 an hour for workers that are making under $20 an hour.
Wow, well, I'd just like to jump in here on agriculture, and certainly in the rural communities, I feel, as with agriculture, people have often been very resilient, but I think that the capacity to bounce back from some of these challenges are getting more and more difficult, and one of the major factors that I can see is the increased debt loads that farmers are carrying to keep up with the standards that are required for our food systems that we have now, and the other is the challenge we have in getting the dollar back to the farmer that people are paying for their food. So we've got some imbalances in the food system that aren't working. And so there are a lot of ideas and lots of ways people can shift that. But in terms of larger scale agriculture, in at least from what I see, we really need to figure out how we can get farmers a higher return for their product that will cover their costs and take into consideration the debt loads and the actual cost of production, which right now is causing a really big challenge. And it comes back to what we're talking about with fuel too. I mean, we have a cheap food policy in Canada. Mm-hmm. And so until we start realizing that there is a real cost to produce good, healthy local food, and we're willing to pay for that, and we're willing to get that out of the marketplace and through the food chain, then we're going to continue to see farmers get out of business.
Yeah, we don't pay enough for either energy or food.
No, we don't. Right. And so lots of farmers are very resilient and are working at creating new options for themselves, but we do need to see the government step in and say, okay, food security in this province is a critical part of what we need to do here. We want to be able to ensure our future food supply, and so therefore we're going to invest in and work with retailers and create a better system.
I think one of the things that I see in that, I mean, I look at apples and t-shirts in the context of this. Apples and t-shirts. Apples, in Aldershot, a kid on the base opens up his lunch bucket, picks up the apple, and it's a New Zealand apple. He's in Aldershot. Right? In the Annapolis Valley, some of the best apples in the world, right? Purchased by the federal government. Okay. T-shirts. It was during the Democracy 250 celebrations, the provincial government ordered t-shirts made in China. When we have a textile industry in Canada, you know, parts of it are unionized, parts aren't, but nonetheless here at home, we need to look at procurement issues in a very serious way. Mm-hmm. We need to look at procurement both at the provincial level, at the municipal level certainly, and also at the federal level. And look also at opportunities to do production at home. The ACA Co-op that I mentioned is basically become what I would term a kill and chill operation. They used to do secondary processing of chicken. At this point, the quota for chicken remains in Nova Scotia, and so they need to process it to some degree. Literally, they're just killing the chickens, freezing them, and sending them out of province for processing. That's insane.
Just to jump in on that, something that I just found out this morning actually is that Stockwell Day has submitted a proposal to provincial and municipal governments, but I think provincial predominantly, in relation to local procurement restrictions, mm-hmm. and wanting basically to allow international trade rules to be the dominant force, and to, you know, so if a province or a municipality adopts a local procurement policy, then that will be overridden by international trade.
One of our affiliate unions, the Canadian Auto Workers, had a legal opinion commissioned on that very, very recently. And it's a lengthy opinion, and I don't pretend to be a lawyer, and I don't pretend to have the ability to summarize it. But we have been taking this legal opinion, which actually says quite clearly that municipalities that have buy local programs, that actually have the procurement programs that actually make sense and buying in the local economy, are not in any way, you know, seeing themselves the targets of, you know, NAFTA violation proceedings and so forth. So, you know, our affiliate unions, our many affiliate unions throughout the country, have been doing a lot of work. You know, QP, who represents a great deal of the municipal workers in this province, Canadian Auto Workers, who certainly have an interest in seeing production and things like ferries and so forth built here at home in the docks here rather than bought in Florida and other places where they bring a boat up, and it, you know, as we saw with the fire boat about a year ago, purchased in Florida, and it actually turns over in the harbor. It's not built for this harbor. Mm-hmm. And yet we have the facilities to actually make those things here at home.
Mm-hmm. And another one of those is the new farmers market, which has just started construction, I believe last week, is going to have imported solar panels on it, despite the fact that we've made world-class solar panels in Dartmouth for 27 years now. A building that's committed to buying local wasn't able to have locally sourced supplies. So you can add solar panels to your t-shirts and apples analogy. I think when it comes to trade, and you know, we don't want to. I don't think we, not any of us, want to come out of this, you know, promoting protectionism in any way. We want to support buying local. But I think that the mantra that we could all agree to, whether it's agriculture or fishery or labor, is sustainability. You know, absolutely. We're not going to be able to afford apples from New Zealand if oil's $200 a barrel. We need to look at each department, and I think we could all agree to task the new government to look at each department and say, you know, is your department sustainable? You know, are you, you know, whether, and every department could look at it, whether it's education, are we going to be able to keep our, you know, our schools open if, you know, I keep saying if oil's $200 a barrel, but whatever the shock is from whatever, you know, whatever source, you know, is that department sustainable? You know, is our forestry department sustainable? Obviously the report that came out earlier this week indicates that it's far from it. You know, is our food supply sustainable? My God, like, you know, these are very basic things that our ministers can be pushing towards, and that it's not, you know, oh, we have anything against New Zealand apples. We just want to make sure that, you know, we can support ourselves in the future, 10, 20 years from now.
Well, I think the key thing is that the true costs of imported
full cost
food is not included. We don't have to go down the protectionist route. It's just that the costs of transportation and use of energy and greenhouse gas emissions are omitted from the actual price of the product. I was in Atlantic Superstore yesterday, and I don't know what United States strawberries are doing yesterday at the peak of strawberry season in Atlantic Superstore, but there they are. So have the true cost.
The blueberry capital of the world.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think we have to, unless the economic and financial system is restructured to include the true benefits and true costs of production, we're not going to make much headway.
Right.
So we actually have to begin to bring those true costs into the accounting system. So yeah, we have to have an accounting system that includes social and environmental benefits and costs. Without that, nothing's going to change. So I want to come back for a second to your very, very beginning of this. I'm not sure that what we want to look at is called quote-unquote recovery. Mm-hmm. I think we're talking about a restructuring of the economic system, and it won't look the same. It can't look the same. I've got a quote here from Georges Monbiot, who says, quote, climate breakdown, peak oil, and resource depletion will all dwarf the current financial crisis in both financial and humanitarian terms. So unless we start thinking long term, this current economic meltdown is going to seem like very small potatoes compared to what
addressing those issues, though, will, you know, will, you know, employ people. It will put people back to work. It will give people security. All those short-term things that, you know, people are getting frantic about.
And not only that, but there are very creative solutions that are not nearly sufficiently looked at. The current solution that's being touted, and I hate to say it, but from right to left across every across the whole political spectrum, from the most right wing to the most left wing, is economic stimulus. But it was debt-fueled growth that led us into the mess, and now, as a solution, debt-fueled growth is being promoted as a solution. This was the problem. So now we're going to go deeper into debt. Who's going to pay the debt? Mm-hmm. Our children and our children's children, both in financial and ecological terms. So there are ways to avoid unemployment, like shorter work hours, spreading the burden in the workforce at large. So some, there's five Nova Scotia firms at this point actually doing that. Stanfield's in Truro and Composites Atlantic in Lunenburg, and one of the Michelin plants. Instead of laying workers off, they're giving them a four-day work week, and then they can use employment insurance provisions to provide employment insurance for the fifth day. So people get 20% more time off work, but their pay only goes down between 8 and 10%. And so the burden is spread in a way that's affordable to the larger workforce, and no one gets laid off. The true costs of unemployment haven't been properly considered, but every time when you have high rates of unemployment, you have high rates of crime, family breakdown, spikes in illness, disability, and so forth. So there are other ways to avoid unemployment aside from simply re-stimulating the economy. I think we have to learn to shrink the economy creatively and restructure.
When we talk about economic stimulus, though, the labor movement has a united position on economic stimulus in terms of the type of stimulus we're looking for. And contextualize that for a moment. The Employment Insurance Fund in Canada had a $52 billion surplus, $52 billion, which was stolen from workers. It was taken from workers from that fund and stolen and put into general revenues, right, by the Tory government. Workers who are receiving employment insurance, much like workers who are receiving social assistance from the province, every dime of what they receive goes into the local economy in a very serious way. They're, unlike corporate tax breaks, which the dollars quite often are going out of province and actually going, you know, oftentimes into Bermuda. I mean, when you think of large employers, who I won't name, Irving, who take their tax breaks and literally ship them overseas into bank accounts that have no taxes and so forth. The dollars that are spent on social programs, the dollars that are spent on social services in terms of the provincial model or employment insurance at the federal model are spent in the local economy. That's economic stimulus in a real way, right? And also bringing up people's standard of living. Pensions is crucial. Retirement security, we're seeing seniors who are living in the most dire of straits at this point. Money that goes into seniors' pockets, low-income seniors' pockets, is money that's spent locally and actually does stimulate the economy. So the type of economic stimulus which we're looking for in the labor movement isn't, you know, pumping billions of dollars into corporations, not taking an equity stake, and giving no measurable standards in terms of what to look for. We're looking for very specific things. We want a doubling of the CPP. We want to see people go from receiving 25% only of what they were making when they retire to receiving 50%. We want to see that phased in over the next few years. Because right now, people are so dependent on primarily pension plans which don't have a defined benefit associated with their defined contribution plans, RRSPs. Right? And we see what's happened. From October onwards, RRSP portfolios dropped 40-50%. We see workers who were planning to have their retirement in the next 3-4 years, who their retirement is going to be extended 5-7 years easily, if not more. One of the ways to protect that is to ensure that we have a CPP plan and an old age security plan that actually can cover some of the most basic needs. So then on top of that, we have retirement plans that we negotiate in our collective agreements or we win from our bosses, which are basically supplemental and aren't what's absolutely needed to get by. We also see a need for pension regulation. We've seen pension plans in this province. I come from a small town in New Brunswick called Nakawik, which is a pulp mill town. When the mill went under, they stole from the pension fund, and I'll say stole at risk, from the pension fund millions of dollars, leaving the pension fund severely underfunded, having taken pension contribution holidays for years and years, a profitable company. And the pensioners are now faced with massive reductions, 40 to 45% reductions in the money which they were promised in a defined benefit plan. We need to have regulation. It costs nothing, again, right, to see regulation in the system that actually ensures that these money market thieves are not walking away with workers' pensions.
Yeah, I think that's fundamental, that we have to encourage the NDP government to stand up to this kind of mindless and heartless deregulation of Stockwell Day and the Harper government. It's just crazy that we would continue to pursue that road when that's led us to such a disastrous economic meltdown.
Deregulation and privatization as well. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this notion of ERs, closing rural ERs as well, when we talk about the rural economy, I mean, that also would destroy communities as well as the rural economy. You know, there's a large number of jobs that exist in rural ERs, and so again, something that that Daryl Dexter and the new NDP government needs to consider is you know, this privatization that's happening in the healthcare system and how to stop that, including this new telecare contract. You know, bringing the private clinics that exist in Nova Scotia into the public system, and making sure that those ERs stay open so that the rural communities will continue to exist, especially with all the industry shutdowns that have been occurring. You know, how else will rural communities continue to thrive? You know, if the continuation of everything being shut down and privatized and deregulated, if that trend continues to occur in Nova Scotia, you know, in a province that is very rural-based, then I think we'll be seeing some huge problems.
And we see the Roddy McDonald government furthering that by explicitly attacking workers and their unions in the healthcare sector. Mm-hmm. Bill 1, which the McDonald government introduced, would remove 35,000 workers' right to strike, a fundamental right in the trade union movement, a right that we fought for, you know, that generations have spilt blood to ensure that we have. That Bill 1 and the removal of the right to strike, even the threat of the removal of the right to strike, and although McDonald knew he couldn't pass that through the legislature, he refused to put the bill forward to actually have it defeated in the House. Bill 1 actually was an impediment to recruitment and retention of healthcare providers to this province. And in fact, we saw healthcare workers, I met healthcare workers from one end of the province to the other, who were leaving the province because they didn't want to work in a province in which their rights, their fundamental rights as workers, were being eroded by the provincial government. Mm-hmm. And so they were applying for jobs in other jurisdictions where those types of rights weren't being attacked. Again, zero cost to stopping the attacks on workers.
People leaving Nova Scotia has been a problem here for a long time.
And recruitment and retention, particularly in the healthcare system, is a super problem.
One thing too, I don't know if we're looking at enough, and I mean, healthcare is not my area of expertise by any chance, but I know it was a field where my mother worked, and she struggled a lot with just getting enough money to keep a home care system operating, which is much, much, much cheaper than having people come into the hospital. So things like midwives or home care, where you're actually giving people care in their home, so you're not having the high cost of infrastructure for every single patient, make a huge amount of sense from an economic perspective, and are again a shift in attitude. Like, I think that a lot of the things that we can move forward on are not necessarily, they don't need economic stimulus, they need a stimulus of intelligence and attitude change to make them happen. And they need to cut the status quo, like stop the status quo, and stop the relationships that have been in, and I'm speaking again just for Nova Scotia, but I think sometimes it's across the board, the relationships that exist between certain governments and corporate entities, that those have to stop and change. And, you know, the U.S. is looking at how to restructure their healthcare system, and of course the health insurance people of the big advocates about not changing the healthcare system because they're making money off of it. But I think that's one thing that has to change. And then the other thing is, I mean, again, in terms of health, it comes to eating locally, but also how we get around. Like, one way to make sure that we can actually work a 4-day work week is to not have a car, right? Cars cost a lot of money. So how do we get from point A to point B? Is the government investing in much in public transit or active transportation so that people can afford to earn a bit less, which is ultimately what we're going to have to do. But we don't have the systems or the infrastructure in place to do that comfortably. We feel that pain. If I have to give up my car, I feel the pain, right? I don't think, oh, it's no problem, I'll just get on that bus, or, oh, no problem, I can ride my bike in that nice bike lane. We're not investing in those things that will help us transition. And I think that is the real challenge for this government. If they can do it, is to build that transition to an economy that's environmentally and socially respectful, which we don't have right now. And it'll take some courage and some real breaking of relationships. And it remains to be seen if they can do it. But again, I don't think, like you say, a lot of stuff has to cost a lot of money. It's just, let's shift how we think.
I think for all these different departments that there's the answer to move them into the new way of thinking. It doesn't require a lot of money. It's more of a policy and a regulation, and it's a mindset. My question, when I think of energy, I think of, despite being involved in the renewable energy business from a sale of products point of view, that not using energy in the first place is always the cheapest solution. Insulating and using better is always the best. What can we do in our healthcare system to encourage more preventative measures, to encourage people to be healthy? You touched on it with transportation, which is another whole issue that we should get into. But, what can we do to just, encourage people to live healthier, and stop them from coming into the hospital in the first place?
Well, part of our problem, I think, in the healthcare system, and it's one about home care I want to come back to, because I think it's absolutely crucial in terms of priorities. But one of the problems in our healthcare system is the fee-for-service component of the billing system. Physicians, anesthesiologists, other professional healthcare providers bill based on the tongue swab or based on a service that they provide. Mm-hmm. That's a model which is frankly incredibly outdated. We need to look at putting physicians on salary, paying them, and actually having them work, right? Rather than billing by the number of tongue swabs which they're doing, you work an 8-hour day, and you have a salary, and you see patients. And part of your role should be to ensure that patients are healthy and they actually do preventative care. Because in the fee-for-service model, there is nothing within any of those service codes, those fee codes, which actually allows a physician to get paid for helping someone to have preventative care. I want to come back to home care for a second, because home care, I think, is absolutely crucial in our healthcare system. It's absolutely crucial in terms of keeping our seniors in their homes. And seniors, I talked about earlier, in terms of their eroding pensions and so forth. For a senior to be able to stay in their home and age in place in a respectful way, home care is absolutely, absolutely crucial. But one of the problems in our society, we have to set priorities around things. And there's two areas in which we clearly do not prioritize: elderly people and children. Who gets paid the least in our society? People who do home care work, people who are daycare workers. Mm-hmm. They get paid absolutely minimal. I met just yesterday a home care worker. They've worked for 19 years doing home care for a succession of home care agencies, privatized agencies that provide care through negotiated agreements with the state, with the healthcare system, and then go into people's homes. This woman, 19 years in place, makes 20 cents more than the minimum wage in this province. On top of that, she pays for her own gas and her own time to go from one client site to another client site to another client site to another client site in a wide geographic area. And so she's actually paid 20 cents more than minimum wage for only the hours in which she's actually in a home. Right? That makes no sense at all. Right? And again, it actually doesn't allow us to recruit and retain professionals. The priorities have got to shift. We've got to look at children. We've got to look at seniors. We've got to look at
food security.
And food security, of course, is true. Absolutely.
Farm laborers are paid at the bottom of the line of income.
And within farm laborers, here in Nova Scotia, where we have high unemployment rates, particularly in rural areas, we have employers in the farm system which are availing themselves of the temporary foreign worker program. And this program does not allow workers who are coming into this country from overseas to be able to regularize, be able to become citizens. It actually excludes that. A temporary foreign worker, when they come into this country, they can do work for 24 out of a given 36-month period, and they must go home. They cannot apply within that period for regularization status. Same thing for nanny care. Why do we allow the temporary foreign worker program to be used to have high-quality Filipino nurses, well-trained women coming into this country and work for one private individual in their home? Why aren't we opening child care centers in every block and paying workers well so we can have child care available to everyone, block by block by block? Why is the federal government and the provincial government subsidizing a program for the richest in society through administering the temporary foreign worker program, subsidizing a program for some of the most wealthy farmers in our province by enabling them? And also, the temporary foreign worker program is one of the most racist pieces of work I've ever seen. The employer, the boss, is actually able, it's the only place in employment law where the boss gets to pick the nationality of the worker. The boss says, well, I had the Ecuadorians last year. Didn't work out. I'd like some Mexicans this year. And the federal government operates as an employment agency on nationality basis. It's outrageous, without any ability to bring people in. Brother Rick Clark, who's the president of the Federation of Labor, he worked on the docks for many years. And Rick talks about what they call an approvership program, which they had in place on the dockyards here, where immigrant workers came in, were trained in the dockyards, on the job, developed skills, went through immigration status, and became members of our community. That's what we need to see. We don't need to see workers abused, put in shacks, and sent home.
Whether it's importing cheap labor or importing cheap food or importing cheap energy, I mean, I think we can all agree that importing's got to stop. But at the same time, Nova Scotia, it's got to stop. Got to get restructured in some way. At the same time, Nova Scotia is a major exporter. Can we run an export economy and be sustainable?
Go ahead.
Oh, I don't know. I think export's an incredibly important part of what we do. I think that is part of our sustainability plan. I don't think we can exclude it for some companies. There are niche markets out there that we're able to provide something here to that place that no one here even wants. Mm-hmm. So I think that's pretty critical to how we move forward, taking that into consideration.
I think the question is not yes or no. It's a question of what are the true costs of imports and the true costs of exports?
Yeah.
So it's how the food is grown, how it's transported, where it goes. So I think all of those things have to be taken into account. I mean, there's a huge opportunity. I think you said before, there's a tremendous opportunity at this moment. People, when during a boom period, no one wants to change anything. Everyone's just riding high on the hog. But it's at a moment like this that people are maybe more open to change. I think, Suzanne, you put your finger on the critical word when you said courage. The real question in my mind is will this new government have the courage to do more than tinker? You know, in other words, to really take some serious steps. We have everything it takes in terms of a wonderful province, creative people, like you said, manufacturing solar panels in Dartmouth. We actually have a genuine progress index ready to use that is a full cost accounting system. It's all just ready to be applied. And we're one of the few places in the world that has that. So we could implement all of that, but then it takes courage, because then we have to say to Stockwell Day, sorry, according to our accounting system, it's cheaper for us to buy local because we're taking full costs into account. Take us to the World Trade Organization panel. We'll fight it because we've got our accounting system to. But it takes some courage.
I also think it takes courage on the. I mean, every Nova Scotian has to be involved in that courage taking, and that we have to stop, expecting things from government and not wanting to give back to what the society we want to create. And that happens a lot here. And not across the board at all, but we have expectations and we complain we don't get what we want, but we don't necessarily work towards what it is we really want.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that every individual in the province, if we're talking about just Nova Scotia, has to join that movement globally that's mm-hmm. happening. And I think that we have to demand accountability for economic stimulus funds. We have to set what we want them to be accountable for. And if it's the shovel ready thing is the biggest bunch of crap that, it really is, because it's not going to get us what we want. It's going to get quick projects that build, big schools that don't have environmental standards, or repair a bunch of big highways or twin mm-hmm. highways or whatever it is. It's going to be big things that are big chunks of ugly concrete mostly that don't actually bring us closer to where we I think, want to be. And that's where that thinking and really holding the government accountable, and not every individual is going to hold the government accountable, but people represent people really need to hold that accountability. Are we meeting environmental goals? Are we being creating a humane society? And it's those things that are going to be hard to do, because it's nice to go to community and say $100 million coming your way. Don't you worry, worry your pretty little head. People got 4 call centers coming in. You're going to be employed. Call centers are making you very depressed. Mm-hmm. So how do we get people to expect more too? We have to expect more.
Yeah. Just to differ with you just slightly, because I agree with 95%.
I know what you're differ with
of what you're saying. 95%, absolutely. But our communities are actually suffering from an infrastructure deficit.
Oh, absolutely.
And our municipalities are desperately underfunded. Absolutely. We look at the Cape Breton Regional Municipality, for example, which was forced. Mayor John Morgan of the Cape Breton Regional Municipality was forced into going to court against Rodney MacDonald, or to make an attempt even to open up dialogue with the province around proper funding for municipalities.
But I think, I'm not saying we don't need infrastructure. I'm saying if you're building a highway, you better build a bike lane.
If you're building a school,
it better be the most beautiful, environmentally friendly school that we can possibly imagine. Use the same dollars to do the same thing, but do it smarter.
And then beyond that, they need to be schools and recreation centers and highways that we as people own, that we as province have complete control over, and not some type of public-private partnership that gives the ownership to someone else. We take on the risk. We take on all the risk. Today, I travel throughout the Atlantic region and spend a lot of time driving the Cobequid Pass to New Brunswick, where I grew up, and I pay $4 every time I go, and that $4 goes to New Jersey, every dime of it, and there is no need for this. Right? We could own our highways. We can own our recreation centers. We can own our schools. Mm-hmm. Building public-private partnership schools is the most insane thing in the world. We've seen here in Nova Scotia, and certainly in Ontario, examples where it becomes unaffordable for that school and that school district to run after-school programs, because they're paying additional rent for every hour they use that facility to a private corporation. They can't run their after-school programs. They can't have kids on Saturdays to play basketball or go to the gym or do the music programs, because they're renting by the hour a facility. It's insane.
What if that $4 went back to pay for transit in rural communities?
That'd be fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's my point, is that, we talk about health and education, public transportation, agriculture failing, but they haven't failed as much as they've been made to fail in the interests of corporations that want to take a lot of these things over.
Mm-hmm.
So we need honest government that will address our needs, not the needs of corporations.
And that's it. And there's a provincial, a municipal, and a federal role in this. But one of the biggest problems we've got right now is a federal government, which actually insists they have an agreement through Partnerships BC, which is Gordon Campbell's pet enterprise, to receive dollars, receive infrastructure dollars, to receive any dollars from the federal government, you have to examine
P3.
A P3 option
mm-hmm.
through Partnerships B3, Partnerships BC or another similar private agency. So you have to look at this. And mm-hmm. you have to put considerable time and effort into looking at it. And once you put that considerable time and effort into looking at it, if you're small, and money into looking at that, if you're a small municipality, then it makes no sense to not go forward with it at that point. Once you've put the considerable efforts into it.
How do we answer what Susan asked? How do we get Nova Scotians to expect more?
I think
studying the example. I mean, being doers and just talking like this, I suppose, and hoping more people will tag along.
I think one thing Nova Scotians will respond to, everyone is willing to make some sacrifice for their children. Everyone's used to doing that. They do, you know, they care. So if we ask ourselves what kind of Nova Scotia are our children inheriting, and are we willing to make some sacrifice now to invest in the kind of infrastructure and the kind of vision which will produce a good world for our children, I think you'll have Nova Scotians on board in droves, and there are hundreds of thousands. I think that people are not just looking every moment at their own immediate needs and wants and desires. I think they are willing to. Nova Scotia is that kind of place. We haven't jumped completely onto the materialist bandwagon. We're not Toronto, we're not New York, we're not Los Angeles. The Maritimes are different, and community matters. The quality of the environment matters to people here. There's a certain quality of life and values which matter. And
Gerald, I think Dexter would say families matter.
Families matter, and families include children, families right? So what kind of Nova Scotia, if we start talking that language, we can get people to think longer term and be willing to be fully supportive of changes which maybe will require a little belt tightening on our part for the sake of future generations.
Are there places though that we can look to? Because a lot of the time it's this made in Canada solution or made in Nova Scotia solution, and I often think, you know, there's got to be a place that's doing that really well.
Venezuela.
That we could just look at. And mm-hmm. Yeah, and that may be for some things. Then are there the pieces that we need to change? Where do we look to get mm-hmm. those examples mm-hmm. so that we're not spending, you know, how many government panels an hour, you know, how much time, because we only have 10 years. So mm-hmm. how do we fix it in 10 years? Mm-hmm. Where are the places that we look to that have the society's economies that mm-hmm. that we'd like to have?
I take inspiration from the social movements of the Global South. And the social movements of the Global South have been, you know, since the globalization phenomenon and the anti-globalization movement which countered it have become into a profound magnifying glass, really, post 1993, 94, perhaps. We see some real movements towards fight back in communities where, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you wouldn't actually have expected it. And part of that is about the type of dialogue that we're having here. It's about bringing civil society together around the table. You know, we see a number of representatives from, you know, around the table here, representing different segments of society and having a dialogue. I think we need to broaden that. I think we need to broaden it in a very serious way. The Venezuelan and Bolivian models involve, you know, popular education, and they involve communication and democratic participatory democracy in local communities. And I think that's something which we need to begin to embrace. People need to feel some sense of hope. Mm-hmm. They need to feel some sense of empowerment mm-hmm. and not be as alienated from, you know, both their work and decision making as they are in our mm-hmm. current society. But in order for people to feel that hope, we need to rebuild social movements. Social movements in Canada and actually in North America at large have frankly collapsed. They don't exist in the form in which they existed in the 70s or into the early 80s. They certainly don't exist in the way that they existed in the 1930s during the First Depression, when we had workers come together in work camps and you know, across the country, and particularly in the west of the country, and form work camp unions when they were sent off. When you had workers who came together from one end of the country to the other to ensure that their sisters and brothers in Spain weren't going to be suffering under a fascist regime, and they sent people under the Mackenzie Papineau Battalion, not a government brigade, but a brigade of average people, workers, to Spain to fight off the fascists. We need to look at models that we've developed here in Canada, as well as models from other places. And I certainly take inspiration from the Global South.
And there's other wonderful examples in the world. The Netherlands reduced its unemployment rate from 12.2% down to 3%, largely by redistributing work hours, by making part-time work attractive, by offering equal hourly pay for part-time workers, prorated benefits, equal opportunity for career advancement. So people work shorter hours. They have the shortest work hours of any industrialized country. But work is redistributed in a way that creates more jobs for more people. In the Scandinavian countries, when unions bargain with their employers, it's these days more often for family-friendly work arrangements rather than just for higher wages. Bhutan, where we've done quite a lot of work, 37 years ago, their king declared gross national happiness is more important than gross national product. And they take it very seriously. They refuse to log their old growth forests, even though they could be bringing in a lot of foreign exchange, because their timber is very, very valuable, but they don't do it. 26% of the country is under complete environmental protection. They limit tourism, even though it's very beautiful, because it could be bringing in a lot of foreign exchange, but they realize it would be a threat to their culture. They banned the sale of cigarettes, even though the World Trade Organization said, how can you do this? It's a legal product that is allowed to flow across borders. But they said, no, it's bad for the health of our citizens. It's as bad as many drugs that are illegal. We're not going to allow it. So, I mean, they've taken some courageous steps. But there are many good examples in the world. If we borrowed from the best practices that existed in Europe and in parts of the South, I think we could easily tread on very well-proven paths to a better system.
I think that that given the results of the current election, people are willing to accept new bold changes, and that they're looking for people to show leadership, given all of the media and all of what's going on around the crises environmentally and healthcare, and they are worried about our future and future generations, but they don't know how themselves to actually do anything about that to affect that change. And I think that they are looking at this new leadership to make those big steps and just really pull it together and in bold sorts of ways. And that's something that I think is extremely exciting, because it is the first sort of major thing in my lifetime that I can think of that really causes me to think, okay, there's really a good possibility here that something serious can shift. So I think it's I think that citizens, through their vote this time, have really said, okay, we're ready for something a little bit different here.
Mm-hmm. But the easiest thing to do is to bail out Clearwater and kind of keep the same kind of thing going, rather than put $10 million into...
Into supporting small scale sustainable fishermen would go so much farther in the grander scheme of things. And that doesn't happen. But I mean, maybe there'll be a change now, but that remains to be seen. Again, fisheries are slightly different because they're federally regulated. So,
but I mean,
a little bit out of the purview, but the marketing part is all the province, and it was the province to give $10 million.
Or, I mean, I think that for us, we are small and we need to pay attention, that paying attention to the small scale is what will be our success in the future. Mm-hmm. And if we don't just really slash some of these sort of big, broad kinds of thoughts and bring it down to how are we going to support local mm-hmm. initiatives, like the micro-lending stuff, I mean, mm-hmm. that is just really important right now. Yeah. And given the fact that it's so difficult for new graduates to start up businesses, these kinds of things will make it be that we can have more diversity in our communities and what there is offered in terms of services.
You mentioned micro-lending, and I think that's something that for small-scale renewable energy can be extremely important, because if you're looking at a renewable energy product, say a solar panel from Thermodynamics or a small wind turbine or even some kind of sustainable pellet furnace or something like that, you're investing up front for benefits over the long term. You're essentially offsetting money that you would have been sending over to the province for 20 years and spending a bulk of that today. We're talking about economic stimulus, and that's bringing all that money you're spending today, and the problem is that it's a big capital cost through small loans, but it wouldn't cost the provincial government anything to guarantee those loans. A commercial organization or a credit union could take on the loan, and all they'd have to do is guarantee it. So there's no money out of the fund, but yet you're generating all this economic activity from it. And that could apply to business. It could apply to any other industry too. Yeah. Sure.
And it really applies to agriculture too. And it comes back to in terms of the micro lending and how beneficial that could be to getting more new entrants into agriculture, just starting and getting into it. But the procurement thing is going to be what's really important in terms of our overall health. If we do not have good, healthy local food in our schools and in our institutions, then we are just setting ourselves up for more future costs in healthcare. And the fact that, for me, that the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health over the years haven't really worked more closely together in terms of the importance of agriculture on our healthcare has been a real disconnect that I don't quite understand. So hopefully, as we move forward, we can really find more bridging those gaps that really are about our long-term health and sustainability.
Yeah. See, I think what it comes down to is this new government willing to ask the question, what matters to us? And with an example like this, does it matter to us to have small local farms? Does it matter? Is it important to Nova Scotia to have some local food security or not? Now, we issued our first report on farm economic viability in Nova Scotia almost 10 years ago, and we showed that net farm income was declining, debt was increasing, and we said very clearly that local farming is endangered. Nothing much happened, and last year we issued our second report 9 years later and showed that net farm income had now dropped to below zero in four of the last 6 years. So. But I'm really tired of saying I told you so, you know, and saying so we warned about this 10 years ago, you know, and we don't have another 10 years.
No,
because if business as usual continues, there won't be local farming in Nova Scotia. Then the only place to get our apples from will be Chile and Washington. There won't be any other source. So it's really we no longer have the luxury of another 10 years of tinkering. You know, we issued our first report on forestry in Nova Scotia about 9 years ago, and I saw in yesterday's newspaper, clear cutting is devastating the province, the lead front page story. So there was a little tinkering, and some little good things happened, like the silviculture credit system was slightly adjusted for the first time to give some silviculture rewards for sustainable logging. So clear cutting dropped from 98% of all harvesting to 94%. Well, is that progress? Yes, kind of. But 94% is still enough to devastate the province. So, I mean, I think the choice, the courage word again, is, you know, we could have 4 years of tinkering, you know, or we could have used this opportunity for 4 years of real shift towards a genuinely prosperous and sustainable economy for Nova Scotians. It's possible. We have all the means. We have the knowledge. We know what to do. We know how to do it. All the alternatives are there. But it's just a question of, you know, will this government really take the bull by the horns and do it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing, we talk about buying local and all this local sources. Another thing that, and Jeff and I are both involved with companies that take advantage of this, is investing locally.
Yeah.
We take, when I was involved with the local seed a couple of years ago, it was about $600 to $660 million a year Nova Scotians invest in RSP money, and 2% of that gets invested in Nova Scotia. And it's probably like, you know, the very large companies. When you said, you know, moving from 98% clear cutting to 94, and I thought, well, geez, if we increase the amount that we invested in Nova Scotia from 2% to 6%, well, that would be all this, you know, that would be tens of millions of dollars of local money going to small local community-owned business. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just like buying local food and buying local product. It's another incentive that the new government can push, and they did pledge to increase the equity tax credit. I think we need to do more for promotion of these companies.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I'm sure Jeff can attest to, it's difficult going out and getting people, you know, small local companies to go and compete for RSP dollars versus, you know, the corporate banks that are going to have big commissions, and, you know, they're, you know, if it's not traded on the TSX, they're not interested.
Now is such a good time for that, because everybody's lost everything on the TSX.
Yeah, I know.
It's such a good opportunity to show, like, that where you can have much less riskier investments.
Yes.
You can get that
30% back by investing locally right away.
The labor movement is actually taking the lead on this, in fact. And I think it'd be remiss to not, you know, put it out there that we in the labor movement across the country saw this need many, many years ago, and we formed labor sponsored investment funds. So here in the Atlantic region, we have the GrowthWorks Atlantic Fund, which its board of directors isn't made up of a bunch of you know, folks who are wearing suspenders and spending, you know, workers' money by throwing it down to the BRIEX. It's made up of workers who are elected. So Brother Rick Clark, for example, the president of the Nova Scotia Federation of Labor, sits on the board of GrowthWorks Atlantic Limited. And this fund spends only in the local economy. Out of this fund right now, we're funding very small producers. There's a small producer of ships, not big ships, but like small sailing ships. There's small producers in the pharmacy industry that are being produced funded here in Nova Scotia on this basis. And there are certainly tax credits available to workers who are buying into this fund. The labor movement, starting in Quebec, and then led secondly by BC, have been doing this for about 25 years in our labor sponsored funds.
Any last thoughts? Because we'll.
I'm just in thinking about the examples of other countries that we can look to. Just in relation to energy, I was thinking about Germany, because Germany is the perfect example to look to in terms of they're currently decommissioning their nuclear power plants and looking at much more renewable energy sources. And I think here provincially, we at the Council of Canadians certainly would love to see a significant increase in funding and support to public renewable power, conservation and energy efficiency measures. But you know, in relation to the public renewable power, I think a major theme here is looking at doing things locally, and you know, one option is for municipalities to provide their own energy sources. Nova Scotia Power Incorporated could also be brought back into the public sphere and become a crown corporation again. You know, I think that would be a positive direction to take. We really, as a province, need to make energy security more of a reality for Nova Scotians, because we import so much, like you mentioned initially there, Dan. We import so much of our energy from international sources to meet the energy needs here. And, you know, those sources are unstable. They're coming from, you know, coal, dirty coal coming from Colombia. And you know, one... you know, it's concerning to know that if something were to happen in the relationship between Canada and Colombia, for example, like the free trade agreement that they're currently negotiating, if that falls through and there's a bad taste in Colombia's mouth and they say, hey, I think we'll stop exporting to Nova Scotia now, you know, or to Canada overall, then
meet our greenhouse gas emission targets.
We
anyway.
Sure would, because we couldn't turn our lights on or do anything else, you know, so. So I think that's something else that the new government should look towards.
Yeah, we think we're in a crisis now from financial stuff, but it could get a lot worse. So let's hope we don't get to the next crisis before we turn around and start restructuring. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks,
Kyle. Thanks.